From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The acting chief of Homeland Security has ordered an investigation into what are being called offensive and threatening social media posts that some Border Patrol agents allegedly posted on a secret Facebook group. Acting Secretary Kevin McAleen said today the posts are inexcusable and disturbing. Meanwhile, the department's inspector general issued a report yesterday. It confirms complaints from Democratic lawmakers that detention centers on the Texas border are overcrowded, unsanitary, and a danger to migrants and agents inside. NPR's John Burnett has been following this story. He joins us now from Austin, Texas. The acting secretary of Homeland Security is calling for an investigation into this secret Facebook page where, as we said, agents allegedly made jokes about migrant deaths and making threats against some Democratic lawmakers. Is this a sign that the administration is taking this seriously?
It's hard to say. The CBP, which is over the Border Patrol, has a new commissioner. It's Mark Morgan. He's Trump's guy. Will he crack some heads if he finds out who's behind this this redneck Facebook site? We'll have to see. 9,500 members on this page is a lot of people, even if some are former agents. But a senior official in the department who I respect says it's very embarrassing. It's not consistent with the vast majority of agents he knows and works with. The invitation to the page describes it as where old patrol meets new patrol. And this official wondered how many participants were even ever in the Border Patrol and how many were just trolls. What I can say is that really in the last few years, things have gotten much more intense in the agency. First, they have a president they openly support who's encouraged them to be even more gung-ho and says he has their back. Second, they are dealing with this historic flow of immigrant families crossing the border illegally. Many of the agents are occupied processing these migrants and making hospital runs with them, which they say is not what they signed up for. So, yes, I've heard there's lots of frustration, low morale, but nothing justifies the kinds of obscene racist content that we saw on this site.
What more can you tell us about the Inspector General's report that found squalid conditions inside the detention centers in Texas?
Well, they found hundreds of children that had been in jail cells that are completely inappropriate for kids. They'd been there for more than 72 hours, which is what the federal limit is before they have to be transferred to child shelters. In one instance, they found 50 little kids younger than seven who'd been in these conditions for over 2 weeks. They didn't have access to showers. There was no laundry to wash their clothes. Some were not getting hot meals. The auditors also found adults in cells that were standing room only for days. DHS says it agrees that it's, quote, an acute and worsening crisis because they can't handle this historic surge of families and kids coming across the border.
On top of that, we heard from a group of doctors who treat children at migrant shelters. They had a press conference yesterday. Here's one of them, Dr. Carlos Gutierrez. He works with migrants and says they tell him that when they were in detention, they had their medicine taken away by border agents, and that outside doctors like him are not allowed to treat those migrants who are in custody. Here he is.
That is piss poor medical care. That is not medical care. That's malpractice. Let us in there. We could, there's no one better than us to take care of these men, women, and children. We have the contacts of other specialists. They don't.
With the culmination of all these reports coming out, John, could the government, the president, and Congress not do anything? Will it force the hand of them to take some kind of action?
Well, the Office of Inspector General writes lots of reports about problems in DHS and about CBP overcrowding, and the OIG has been writing these reports for years, and also about detention centers run by ICE, but little seems to improve. I think what's going to improve conditions in DHS detention cells is not going to be an inspector general report. It's going to be the federal courts. Last week, a California federal judge, Dolly G, became alarmed about the scandal that we all heard about at the Clint Border Patrol station where these kids were kept in just terrible conditions. She has ordered a mediator to work with the government and fix it. She's, you know, don't hold the children for so long and treat them more compassionately. And this is with the authority of the federal judiciary.
All right. Thank you. NPR's John Burnett in Austin, Texas. Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
Well, the Pentagon said today that top brass were invited to President Trump's 4th of July celebration tomorrow, and many will attend. The Pentagon is scrambling, though, to deliver the military hardware, including B-2 stealth bombers that President Trump has requested for his bash on the country's front lawn. There will be tanks, helicopters, flyovers, an unheard-of display of military might at an event that typically features patriotic music and fireworks, and never a political speech. President Trump will speak. No president has at this event, except Harry Truman in 1951, and his remarks were nonpartisan. The White House says this event will also just be patriotic, but political advisor Kellyanne Conway said the speech will highlight the success of this administration in opening up so many jobs, what we've done for veterans. Paul Rykoff is an Iraq War veteran, founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, now host of the Angry Americans podcast. He says it's veterans and first responders concerned about the direction the country is taking. So, Paul, does that concern include the president's plan for tomorrow?
Oh, absolutely. We'd say in the military, Robin, this is a snafu. Situation normal, all
okay,
I can't
messed
say it
up
on the radio.
Right,
up.
Right.
It's disorganized. It's expensive. You know, right now, they're still trying to pull tanks into Washington, into places that don't support tanks, the infrastructure, the bridges. But on a more basic level, this is not what we do. This is not North Korea. This is not Iran. We don't put our military on display in what is very, very much a political event.
Well, let's take a look at this, because the president would say, well, what about France? They have Bastille Day, where he was first inspired to do this. They have a military display on the day that marks a turning point in the French Revolution. And you know, there are some people who say, well, you know what? I think it's great for kids to see flyovers. I'm looking at a quote from Ron Moeller, an Air Force vet, a former CIA officer, says, you know, this is no big deal. It's been done before. There was a big military parade in the Capitol after the Gulf War in 1991. You know, your thoughts on just, hey, you know, why not for kids to get to see flyovers, and maybe even in the Washington, D.C. area, military families to come out and celebrate their lives?
Well, if you live in D.C., you see military flyovers every day. And if we really want to celebrate the military, I think we should give them the day off. You don't salute the military by dragging them out into concrete in the July heat, standing in dress uniforms for what has really become a display, not of our military prowess, but of political pageantry. Mm-hmm. This doesn't seem to be about the military, and it doesn't seem to be a celebration of America. It seems to be a celebration of this administration and even of this president himself. And that's what's different here. Our military is supposed to be divided from politics, but this is really a culmination of the merging of politics and our military that's happened throughout the administration. This dividing line continues to be blurred, and I think that's what alarms most retired military experts, and a lot of folks in the Pentagon are very deeply concerned about the precedent that this sets.
Well, there is supposed to be a firewall. Members of the military aren't even allowed to participate in partisan events. They're supposed to be loyal to the Constitution and not an individual leader. You've got other people, right, like retired Army General David Barno. He commanded American troops in Afghanistan. He told Politico, this looks like a Republican Party event for the president, and there will be a VIP area. And we know that the Republican National Committee has already given away tickets they got to that VIP area to top donors. By the way, they say that the DNC, the Democratic Party, did the same thing under Obama, but they didn't. They only gave away tickets to White House events. Talk more about that concern about conflation between military and a particular, you know, administration.
The military is not a toy. The military is not a political tool. They are not a photo op to be used for anyone's political agenda from any party or any administration. And that's the deeper concern here again, is that President Trump seems to fail to understand what that line is. He continues to blur it. If he puts troops behind him and accidentally says something political, he's really undermining their separation from our civilians. And this is at a time where they're on the edge of war. So on a very basic level, do we need to do this? If you really want to salute them, understand that they need a day off and they don't need to be dragged into Washington to stand in the sun in uniform or maybe even in the rain so that the president can give a political speech. Well, there's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And I think almost universally, this is viewed as the wrong way to do this.
Well, they might also want the money. It costs $122,000 an hour just to fly the B-2 bomber. The estimates for the parade that the president wanted on Veterans Day, which was very much turned back by the military was over $90 million. I'm imagining veterans, active service, would want that money.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of needs that we have within the military, within the veterans community. If you want to salute the troops, we can focus on the suicide problem that I've talked to you about on this show for, you know, over a decade. We can talk about ways to reform the VA or to focus on unemployment. But it is much bigger than just the money. This is really a demonstration in arrogance and on some levels, logistical incompetence. So let's be grateful it's only a parade and not a military invasion that these guys are running, because it's been a total debacle.
It's Paul Rykoff, Iraq War veteran, also founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and now host of the Angry Americans podcast. A lot of veterans and first responders involved in that podcast. Paul, thank you. And I hope you have a quiet at home with your family 4th of July.
Thank you very much, Robin. Wishing the best to everyone, and happy birthday to America.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
And this can only mean one thing. We are bearing down on the 4th and our annual visit with longtime sousaphile and founder of the new Sousa Band, Keith Bryan, perhaps the country's leading authority on John Philip Sousa, whose Stars and Stripes Forever we're hearing, performed by Sousa himself with his Sousa Band. Sousa composed the piece on Christmas Day, 1896, when he heard that the manager of his band had died. It was something of a tribute to the man. It later became the official code song for bands to signal a life-threatening emergency in theaters and circuses. It was called the Disaster March. Musicians would strike it up to signal workers to ready the exits. Well, it was officially made the National March of the United States in 1987 by an act of Congress. Sousa wrote 135 marches. Some were the first mass-produced recordings, making him one of the first recording stars. Now, Keith Bryan, almost 86, has just completed a lifetime project recording all of Sousa's marches. When he's not traveling the world conducting them, here he is with London Central Royal Air Force Band performing March of the Royal Trumpets. Keith is rarely home, which we know because he's a neighbor, so we're glad he could come into the studio. Keith, great to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
Our little 4th tradition. How many CDs now have you recorded all of Sousa's works?
23 for this series for Naxos.
But I'm looking at the Sousa's Complete Marches for Band. It's 2 pages. Ancient and Honorable, Beau Ideal, Belle of Chicago, Lambs, Pushing On, Quilting Party. He was so prolific.
Indeed.
Where did this all start for him?
His dad was a member of the Marine Band. He would go down to rehearsals with his father, and when he was a teenager, he actually got a job at the Marine Band sweeping the floors and passing out music. So it started practically immediately for him.
Yeah, and became a master at marches. I want to listen to one. This is his right-left march, literally telling people how to march.
That's right.
Were marches in his day?
It was huge because they were also, people danced to them as well as marched to them.
And when did Stars and Stripes Forever become the march of the 4th of July?
Well, I think it was a gradual thing. Certainly the 4th of July back in Sousa's day was not the 4th of July any more than Christmas was Christmas. Big national holidays or something are more of a 20th century, later 20th century thing.
Well, and he didn't just do marches. We have a piece here I want to listen to. I've made my plans for the summer. What is this we're hearing?
It's a little Coney Island waltz about what one would do in the summer at the shore in New York.
But he also composed operettas. I think we have something here, Circus Gallop from the Irish Dragoon.
Yes, this is a lost operetta that never got quite finished, but a few of the pieces remained, and this is a recording of a little gallop that he wrote for it.
Kind of interesting that he fancied himself more of an American Gilbert and Sullivan.
Gilbert and Sullivan were the rage when he was growing up, and they were his idols, and I think he hoped to surpass them.
Well, is this kind of a sad story that even though we love John Philip Sousa for his marches, in his mind he was going to write operettas?
Right, and he did. He wrote 15 of them, roughly, and some of them actually played on Broadway, and some are still being performed.
Yeah.
But he never did equal Gilbert and Sullivan because Sousa was not the talent that both of them together were.
Yeah.
And that hampered his operettas.
But what was he? As somebody who's now recorded all of his works, conducted him around the world, how would you quantify him?
He was just a very talented musician, obviously a creature of his times, a creature of this country at that time. Growing up in Washington, couldn't be more patriotic, as you can imagine. He was born in 1854, so he was around when Civil War troops were marching up and down the street. His father was playing in the Marine Band, so he would go hear his father play at the White House with the Marine Band. That's pretty patriotic.
Yeah. And then had his own Marine Band?
He eventually, at the age of 26, became the youngest ever conductor of the Marine Band.
And left it to form his own band.
Right.
I think of the Civil War veterans that you talk of him watching. You told us once that Sousa wanted his marches to make a man with a wooden leg stand up and dance.
It's a great image.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking there may have been many of them post-Civil War. And
that's true. Many of them didn't have all their legs and arms.
Yeah, and that this was a gift maybe he wanted to give some of the veterans. Listen to a little of his Mother Hubbard march. What's always interesting to me, Keith, is we see you and you're like, I'm off to Japan, I'm off to all these different countries that are embrace Sousa.
They do, worldwide.
Why do you think?
Good tunes, I guess good rhythm and good tunes, it's the combination. And he was really an inventive composer that had very sophisticated training.
And they see it, I'm sure, as American music.
Absolutely.
are so, you know, healthy and vibrant, do you think part of that is that you are channeling Sousa all the time?
Well, I'm told that conductors do well in their later years. Maybe that's what's happening.
All that arm movement, that heart.
When I was about 6-7 years old, my father rented public address systems for big outdoor rallies and things. And he wasn't particularly musical, but the one thing we had in the house to listen to were Sousa marches, because they put them on at political rallies and would play them when his sound truck was driving around town. So it sort of became my cradle music, and I think that's why I got so infected with it, or inspired.
Well, again, I see you traveling the world, recording around the world with different orchestras. Is there some place you haven't yet been able to conduct Sousa and you would like to?
Well, this is, sounds very conceited, but one day I sat down to try to figure out if there were any states where I hadn't conducted. And it turns out there are two, Montana and Vermont.
What's wrong with them?
I don't know. So anyway, that's a thought that's on my mind, and I am talking to some people about a concert in Montana, so maybe it'll come down to one.
Yeah, well, if there's a gazebo there, there's a guy here who can put together a slam-bang Sousa concert for you. That's Keith Bryan, who has just completed a lifelong project recording all of the music of John Philip Sousa.
All of the band music, yep. We must say that.
All the band music, and it will be available over the next 2 years.
That's
but it's
right.
All recorded. And by the way, his recent book on Sousa is Sousa's Marches as He Performed Them. Keith Bryan, thank you so much.
Ah, my pleasure.
And by the way, a student band in Norway holds the record for speed playing this song. Google the Muppets version and, of course, enjoy the Stars and Stripes Forever tomorrow. It's your birthday.
The United Nations is calling an airstrike on a migrant detention center in Libya a war crime. More than 40 people died and dozens more were injured. Libya has been in chaos since its longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed in 2011. It's become a major crossing point for thousands of migrants from Sudan, Somalia, and other parts of Africa. They're fleeing to Europe. The man accused of being behind today's attack is a Libyan general. His name is Khalifa Haftar. He's trying to overthrow the government of Tripoli. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams is following this story. Why would either this general or anybody else want to launch an airstrike on migrants in a detention center?
Well, I think the first thing to point out, Lisa, is that his side, that is the Libyan National Army, says that it was not responsible for this. And indeed, they are claiming that this was in response to an airstrike that they had launched on pro-government forces sometime earlier. The government, for its part, that is the Western, internationally UN-recognized government in Tripoli, definitely does blame General Haftar's forces. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, but it is an unfortunate fact, and one that UN agencies have pointed out, that these migrants are being held sometimes in positions very, very close to active front lines. And indeed, the center that was hit a couple of months ago. And I think the UN is saying, look, we've warned that this kind of thing could happen, and you simply took no notice. The dangers faced by migrants, some 6,000 migrants being held in 60 detention centers around the city, those dangers are very real.
Does it serve anyone's purpose, though, to keep the migrants in areas that are likely to get attacked? I mean, are they kept there intentionally for some kind of currency?
I've not heard that they're being held as kind of human shields. I suspect that this is just clumsiness and, frankly, a reckless disregard for the lives of people for whom, frankly, all sides in Libya have shown absolutely no regard at all.
So the migrants, 6,000 of them from Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and elsewhere, are being held in deplorable conditions. The bigger picture for the international community is in part Libya's strategic position. What is that?
Well, you have the elements of a kind of proxy war going on now in Libya. So you've had this chaos since Gaddafi's fall in 2011. You have an internationally recognized government based in Tripoli, but controlling very little of the country, and a rival administration based in the east of the country, which controls much more territory and is allied to the forces, the Libyan National Army, run by General Khalifa Haftar. He is being supported by the United Arab Emirates, by Egypt, and by Saudi Arabia, while the government in Tripoli is being supported, particularly in recent months, by Turkey. And, of course, listeners will be familiar with those countries being cited as rivals in other parts of the region. And I think there is a big fear here that we are seeing those big Middle Eastern rivalries playing out in yet another forum in Libya.
Thank you for following it for us. Paul Adams, diplomatic correspondent with the BBC, speaking to us from London. Thanks again, Paul.
You're welcome.
That's a familiar soundscape, especially if you live in a big city or commute to one. Maybe you've been stuck in a motionless cab running late for something and thought about just getting out and running instead. Jad Slayman of WHYY's The Pulse takes a look at how cars became king in our cities and how, as congestion grows, some neighborhoods are trying to reclaim the streets.
Kids skate around, dart back and forth, playing tag and soccer. They scream for no apparent reason. It feels like a playground at recess, but it's a city street, 78th Street to be exact, in Jackson Heights, New York City. Almost a whole block of it has been closed to car traffic since 2011. 8-year-old Alexandria and her friends pass around a volleyball. This is her favorite part of the neighborhood.
Because, like, it's large, and also, like, I get to have space to play soccer and other different sports.
Jackson Heights is a diverse, densely packed part of Queens. It's got far less park space than almost every other city neighborhood. Alexandria's older cousin, Sarah, says when the city blocked off the street for the first time, it was weird.
I don't know. It was because, like, we're not used to it because I was so used to cars passing by.
It was a good kind of weird.
Yeah, it was a good kind of weird.
Locals don't think it's weird anymore. In fact, they want more of the street. They're fighting for it. Officials had promised to close the whole block eventually. Standing in their way now, of all things, is a car dealership at one end. They opened last year and want to keep cars flowing in and out of a service entrance. But locals refuse to back down.
We're not going to give up one single inch.
A group of activists first started working on closing the street more than a decade ago, and there was a lot of pushback.
There was fear that we were going to lose parking places. There was fear that we were going to cause traffic on adjacent streets. There was fear that there was going to be, that all of a sudden there's going to be, like, gang turf battles in the street.
That's Donovan Finn, an urban planning professor who was part of the push and lived in the neighborhood. Gatekeepers, as he calls them, city officials, community board members, thought he was nuts.
When you tell people you're going to close a piece of street, they just can't fathom it.
The thing is, Finn was waging a kind of insurgency in a war cars had won decades ago. It was a battle over who the streets were for, and about 100 years ago, it was life and death.
The automobiles were killing people at an incredible rate.
That's Peter Norton, a technology historian and author of Fighting Traffic, a book about how cars made their way into our cities in the first place.
And in cities, the people getting killed were overwhelmingly pedestrians. Many of them were children.
In the 1910s, he says, people had different ideas about what a street was supposed to be.
There were no lanes, no center lines, no line markings. People could stroll where they wanted.
There'd be the occasional streetcars or Model Ts, but no one really looked out for them or even made an effort to get out of their way, probably because early traffic laws made cars super slow.
In the 8 or 10 mile an hour range, I mean, extremely slow by our standards.
If you can just outrun a car, you're not going to buy one. So Norton says car companies lobbied against laws restricting automobiles and for laws restricting pedestrians. We get jaywalking. In Kansas City in 1912, people used to owning the street were offended and angry.
There's one episode where women struck police officers with their parasols for being told not to walk in the street.
So Norton says authorities added an element of public shaming. Here's how one Los Angeles official went about it.
He even recommended that if it was a woman jaywalker, that the police officer should pick her up and carry her back to the curb, because he said this would be so humiliating that it would prevent her from jaywalking ever again.
Meanwhile, it became cheaper to ride in a jitney, a low-cost, unofficial taxi. Think Uber before Uber. And cars got cheaper, too.
The private automobile, even though still relatively few people were driving their own car to work, it didn't take very many of such people to get in the way of the streetcars.
Public transit was getting stuck in traffic and less convenient. In the 50s, lawmakers subsidized thousands of miles of highway.
A 41,000-mile network of our most important roads.
But the final victory for cars, Norton said, started with the kids. By the mid-20s, the top funder of public school safety education was the American Automobile Association, AAA.
They took over the safety patrols, guided the children to school, and helped them cross the street safely. And their message to children was, streets are for automobiles.
As adults, that was ingrained in them. They simply knew the streets were for cars, and the rest is history. Norton isn't a big fan of cars. I expected him to bike to the office, but no, he backs out of his driveway in a four-wheel internal combustion automobile.
And I think that quite arguably makes me a total hypocrite. But my answer is that, like other people, I have to live in the world we've got.
Cars won. That's the world we live in. Millions like Norton have no train they can walk to, no reliable bus. They can't pedal along on a freeway from the suburbs. Even in big cities, public transit is often underfunded and struggling. But is the auto victory a permanent one?
Somewhere around 2003, 2004, I began to notice that people were driving a little less in cities around the country.
That's Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam. He's the New York urban planner who coined the term gridlock. Driving had dipped before, during the Great Depression or the World Wars, but always recovered and grew very quickly. Driving also decreased during the latest recession, which Sam says was expected. But then, after the recovery, when you'd expect rates to shoot right back up, they didn't. And that hadn't happened before.
Millennials were driving 20 to 25% fewer miles. When you see shifts, they're usually very gradual. This was a quantum jump.
Federal data shows rates continued to drop, except among the poorest millennials. Schwartz says that tells him younger Americans want to get by without owning cars. Schwartz knows a thing or two about that. In the 70s, he tried and almost succeeded in getting cars out of a huge chunk of Midtown Manhattan, some 60 blocks.
All cars were going to be banned from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
He got so far as stamping out the signs, but a new mayor scrapped it last minute. It was just too radical. But Schwartz says his ideas aren't so radical anymore. It's not a car ban, but in April, New York officials announced congestion pricing was coming to Manhattan.
New York City is set to become the very first city in the nation to levy a congestion tax on drivers.
Shove this down my throat just like you shoved the bicycle lanes down my throat, and now you want me to pay for it.
Roughly 10 bucks for driving into the city, anywhere between 60...
The fees go to public transit. The idea is less car traffic in dense urban cores, and it's worked in Singapore and London. American cities are watching New York's experiment, and with good reason. In big downtowns, cars are slowing to a crawl. The average speed in Midtown Manhattan last year, 4.7 miles per hour. Experts point to the influx of Lyfts and Ubers, more solo car trips. And Schwartz says we can't pave our way out of congestion anymore.
If we go to Houston, where they kept widening the Katy Freeway to the point where now it has 26 lanes and the traffic is worse, it didn't work.
It's likely the world's widest freeway. Traffic got better when it was first expanded, but eventually slowed right back down.
Do you get up in the morning and you're like, thank God I get to go sit in my car for an hour in traffic?
That's Lynn Richards, president of the Congress for the New Urbanism.
Nobody wants that as an outcome.
They're a collective of engineers and policy wonks. They push for improved public transit and fret over what cars have done to our cities and, by extension, our health and environment. Richards says one challenge is getting people to imagine their lives without cars. Public fear is a big obstacle. And she says one way around that, get tactical.
It's called tactical urbanism.
Start with small car-free spaces and make it temporary so no one freaks out. 78th Street in Queens, that actually started as a temporary thing too. A couple weekends in the summer, then the whole summer, then, hey, why not the whole year?
Very quickly, you know, kids are learning to ride bikes here. People were having birthday parties for their kids.
That's Finnegan, one of the activists behind the 78th Street closure. The most encouraging thing to him, these kids are growing up learning at least one street isn't for cars. It's for them. For Here and Now, I'm Jad Slaman.
You probably wear sunscreen, right? Everybody should. Skin cancer is the leading cancer in this country. 3 million people get it every year. And of course, sunscreen can help prevent that. But recently, FDA scientists published a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association concluding that chemicals in sunscreen are absorbed into your bloodstream. What does that mean? We've brought in Perry Wilson, assistant professor of medicine at Yale. Hi, Dr. Wilson.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Your thoughts? You know, is this bad for us, that what's in that sunscreen that may be helping us may be hurting us?
This study came across my desk as I had just finished applying sunscreen to my children, which is a ritual that we start, you know, sometime in at the end of May, early June in this part of the country. And so it definitely caught my eyes, I'm sure. It did a lot of people. The study was done, as you mentioned, by the FDA. It took 24 healthy individuals and really slathered them in sunscreen. Mm-hmm. For 4 days, they applied sunscreen to almost their whole body every 2 hours during waking time. And they had 30 different blood measurements of the sunscreen chemicals over a 7-day period. So really detailed data. And the reason the FDA did this is because they have a threshold level of a substance that is sort of allowed to be in their blood, in your blood. If you measure something below this threshold, the FDA says, you know what, don't worry about it. It's too little to even really do more studies. In the case of sunscreen, they tested 4 separate active ingredients, and every single one exceeded this threshold. Mm. One exceeded the threshold by 400 times. And what that says is, okay, you're not off the hook. We now need to do the hard work of figuring out not only that it got into your blood, but does it matter?
Right. Well, and so somebody's going to do that hard work. And we know we're going to be hearing from the FDA a little more about sunscreens. But how do we get here? I mean, you know, if there's something that can concern us, why isn't this regulated?
It's a fascinating bit of history, actually. So these sunscreen active ingredients came on the market before the modern era of drug evaluation, which really began in the early 1970s. So they were already out there and they were sort of grandfathered in. The FDA in the early 70s actually did say, you know what, we've got to look at these over-the-counter products and decide whether they are safe and effective. And they have been going through those sort of grandfathered in over-the-counter products since the 70s. And in fact, that project is still ongoing. And to some extent, they're just sort of getting around to the sunscreens now.
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, they absolutely say that there are non-chemical ways to sunscreen. Get your umbrella hat, you know, or clothing that blocks the sun. But when it comes to sunscreens, we also know how valuable they are. I mean, as a doctor who's looking at this, I mean, you weigh risks while we await the determination. Skin cancer is in the other column. I mean, isn't it? Should we err on the side of wearing the sunscreens till we know more?
Absolutely. My biggest concern about this study when I saw it is, oh no, people are going to stop wearing sunscreen. And there's a bit of a devil you know, devil you don't know here. We know for a fact that ultraviolet radiation from the sun causes skin cancer. We still don't know if there's any problem with the fact that sunscreen gets into your blood. And to be honest, given the fact that we've been using it for 50 years and we all seem to be doing okay, I would be rather surprised if we see any risk that exceeds the risk of skin cancer in the population, which, as you point out, is the most common cancer. But your choices are not just limited to chemical sunscreen, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can get hats and shirts and things like that. And by the way, you point out that other things that we do, people who drink coffee should know that there's caffeine in their blood as well.
Well, of course, yeah. So as you look at kind of the concentration of something in your blood, there's this visceral reaction where you say, oh, that's I don't want something in my blood. But of course, we ingest things. We put things in our blood all the time. So just to give some perspective, the concentration of caffeine in your blood after you drink a cup of coffee is about 50 times higher than the highest measured level of one of these sunscreen ingredients. The concentration of nicotine in your blood after you smoke a cigarette is about 7 times lower than that highest sunscreen chemical. So the point here is that, the number might not tell you very much. It's there. But again, we don't know if it's doing you any trouble.
Yeah. So meanwhile, while we wait, we do know, as you said, skin cancer is frightening. It can be fatal. And so use the sunscreens. Or maybe, as you point out, there are the barrier sunscreens. You can, make like a surfer and put zinc on your nose or maybe all over yourself.
The barrier sunscreens are those that contain zinc oxide or titanium oxide. And they work by reflecting those UV rays as opposed to the chemical sunscreen, which absorb the UV rays and release them as heat. The barrier sunscreens, yes, are a bit whitening, but the modern formulations are pretty darn good. And both zinc oxide and titanium oxide are generally regarded as safe and effective by the FDA. So they've gone through that process. So you can feel much more comfortable about using those.
Yeah. Well, if you use just the tube, you look, as you write, like an 18th century consumptive. However, you will be protected. Perry Wilson, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Yale. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
At least, Lisa, no one uses reflectors and baby oil anymore. It's like a fish fry. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.